Welcome to the OHS Connect Knowledge to Action podcast series on risk communication. This is the final podcast segment in this series and is a continuation of our conversation with Dr. Peter Sandman, a risk communication speaker and consultant from the United States. In this segment, we are wrapping up the podcast series with a discussion of practical tips for risk communication. Peter, to start off, I want to ask you, a director, manager, leader often needs to communicate information from the Ministry of Health Services or other organizations to frontline healthcare workers, patients, and families. And at times, this information can be privileged, creating a challenge for the director, manager, leader. What suggestions do you have for these situations?
Well, the single most important lesson, I think, that I can offer about confidentiality is this. Don't hide behind confidentiality as an excuse to avoid telling people things that you don't really want to tell them anyway. Whenever a client says to me, it's not legal for us to reveal that, I immediately ask, are you glad it's not legal, or do you wish you could find a way to reveal it? And usually it's the former. If it's the latter, if you really want to reveal information and there really is a privilege problem or a confidentiality problem, then there's usually, or at least often, a workaround. Quite often the workaround is to ask permission of the person whose personal information you want to reveal. It makes a very big difference, it seems to me, whether you say to your lawyer, we can't reveal that, right? Or you say to your lawyer, how can we find a legal way to reveal that? If you communicate to your lawyer that you really don't want to, your lawyer will say, that's right, you can't. If you say you really want to, but you have to find a way to do it legally, then your lawyer is going to work a lot harder to find the workaround for you. I think that'd be the single most important thing I'd say about confidentiality is don't fake it. It's a real problem sometimes. But I would say about three-quarters of the time when my clients say we're not allowed to communicate X, X turns out to be something they don't want to communicate, and if they wanted to, they'd find a way. Let me say a couple of other things about confidentiality issues. One is if you actually can't tell and you wish you could, then you say exactly that. You don't just say that information is legally privileged. You say, God, I wish I could tell you that. You're absolutely right to want to know that. But the law says I can't tell you, and the law is not stupid. The problem is you have a good reason to want to know it, but the patient that this would reveal information about has a very good reason to want not to have it known, and the law has sided with the patient. So I wish I could give you that information, and I can't. That has a lot of credibility as opposed to just saying the information is privileged. The second thing I'd say is that if you choose not to tell for a good reason, or even for a defensible reason, be honest about the reason rather than just claiming privilege. I looked, for example, at several cities in the U.S. and Canada during SARS where SARS patients were being treated in particular hospitals and government was candid about the existence of the patient but refused to say which hospital. Very often they claimed they were protecting patient confidentiality, but actually they were protecting the hospitals. They were worried that non-SARS patients would avoid hospitals that were treating SARS patients, so they decided that protecting the hospital from stigma was more important than giving patients information they could use to protect themselves from SARS. And I should add that, as you know, there was, in fact, a good deal of hospital transmission of SARS, most of it to healthcare workers. So deciding not to go to a SARS hospital, to a hospital that was treating SARS patients, if you could tell which was which, wouldn't have been foolish. It would have been a sensible thing to do. But some hospitals refused, most hospitals, most cities, refused to name the hospitals where SARS patients were present. That was a debatable decision. There are good arguments on both sides. What it seems to me isn't debatable is that hiding behind patient confidentiality is neither honest nor effective. If you don't want to say where the SARS patients are, you should say you don't want to say and explain why. You shouldn't claim that it's an issue of patient confidentiality.
Peter, how should an organization approach risk communication if the risk level is unknown or unclear, such as H1N1?
Well, frankly, the risk level is usually unknown or unclear. Risk communication is mostly in situations of high uncertainty, so it's a garden variety situation. And the obviously most important thing to do is to acknowledge the uncertainty. People can tolerate uncertainty. They don't like it. People would rather you were certain, and if you are certain, tell them so. But people tolerate high levels of uncertainty in their own lives. They listen to the weather forecast every day, and they know that's uncertain. And they're able to cope with uncertainty if you are candid about it, and you take it as a matter of course. If you say, I don't know what's happening, I don't know how bad it's going to be, and it looks like you're freaking out, and it looks like you can't cope with the uncertainty, then your audience is going to freak out too. But it's not because you're uncertain. It's because you're freaking out about being uncertain. But if your message is essentially, yeah, we're not sure about this risk, there's data on one side, there's data on the other side, it might be a chronic risk, we don't actually know whether this chemical is a carcinogen or not, there are studies in both directions, it might be an acute risk, we don't know yet whether the swine flu is going to turn out severe or not, we haven't seen it long enough, we don't have good enough data in the early days from Mexico. If you communicate in a straightforward way that you are uncertain and comfortable being uncertain, then people are fairly able to accept your uncertainty and cope with it. And there are some stunningly good examples of health professionals sounding matter-of-factly uncertain. During SARS, for example, David Heyman, who was managing the outbreak for the World Health Organization, at one point said, "We are building our boat and sailing it at the same time." Not an original metaphor, you can use it too. He didn't make it up. It's a very vivid way of saying we're making it up as we go along. We don't know what we're doing. We're going to make mistakes. Similarly, in the U.S., Jeff Copeland, who was head of the CDC, I think this was during the anthrax attacks, that Jeff Copeland said, and this is a spectacular quote, he said, "We will learn things in the coming weeks that we will then wish we had known when we started." It's a very clear acknowledgement that, you know, we don't know much yet, and we're making decisions anyhow. We have to make decisions anyhow. We're used to that. That's what public health is like. It's not freaking us out. But some of those decisions are going to turn out wrong when we get more data, and we'll have to back up and change our minds. And if you are matter-of-fact about that, most audiences can get it. In contrast, sounding overconfident backfires. Sometimes it backfires because people believe you when you say you're confident that X will happen, and then Y happens instead, and they rationally conclude that either you're incompetent or you're dishonest. But most of the time, that's not what happens. People smell a rat even before they know whether X or Y is going to turn out to be the truth. They sense that you're overconfident, and paradoxically, their intuition that you're overconfident makes them all the less confident. This is one of many examples of what I call the seesaw of risk communication. When people are ambivalent, they go to the side of their ambivalence that you're not on. They get on the seat of the seesaw that you're not on. So if you're sounding confident and they're not confident and they smell that you're not really confident either, that makes them all the less confident. Perhaps the most difficult aspect of acknowledging uncertainty is acknowledging disagreement within your organization. Disagreement about how serious the risk is, or disagreement about what should be done about it. Most organizations, at least their top managements, believe firmly in the mantra of speak with one voice. And I think almost all crisis communication experts will say speak with one voice is the right recommendation. And I disagree. I should add, this is the first thing I've said in the podcast where I think I'm in a minority among communication experts. Most of what I've been saying in this series of podcasts, although lots of practitioners might disagree, most risk communications professionals would agree. But most risk communication professionals think speak with one voice is the right thing to do in a crisis. And I don't think so, because it backfires, because people either learn that you're wrong or sense that you were overconfident. And so it works backwards. Let me give you a quick example, and that's probably more than you want on this question, but it's a nice example. During the smallpox vaccination program in the United States, one of the issues that the U.S. CDC was concerned about was the frequency with which there would be serious side effects from the smallpox vaccine. The smallpox vaccine hadn't had a lot of use in a generation, so there wasn't very good data. And CDC decided that it would go out to the very small number of experts that existed that had opinions on how frequent smallpox vaccine side effects would be, and try to get a consensus answer, try to get a single estimate so that the CDC and all the experts could speak with one voice on smallpox vaccination side effects. And I recommended against it, and I had two arguments. The first argument was, if you do that, almost undoubtedly whatever number you coerce people into agreeing on is going to turn out wrong. And after you launch the vaccination program, there are going to be news stories about how you were wrong and probably how you were overconfident and you underestimated side effects. And that's not good. The other thing I argued is within minutes of announcing that all the experts agree that the smallpox vaccination program is going to produce, let's say, 15 in a million serious side effects. Within 15 minutes of you releasing that information, some reporter will be Googling the various experts, and 15 minutes after that, the reporter will be on the phone with some expert saying, you signed on to this consensus estimate of 15 in a million, but in a journal article 5 years ago, you estimated 50 in a million. Were you under pressure to change your mind? So you get a news story, the headline of which is something like, government pressures experts to underestimate vaccine risk. So it's going to backfire. I won that particular fight. I didn't win by any means. I don't win all my fights with my healthcare clients or any of my clients. But I won that one. And instead of putting out a consensus estimate, the CDC polled the dozen or so experts that were around, and it put out a news release in which it reported the results of the poll. It said, we talked to the experts, and the most alarmist estimate we got was this number. The most reassuring estimate we got was this number. The mean was this number. The interquartile range was from here to here. And they matter-of-factly reported the disagreements among the experts about how many smallpox vaccine side effects there would be. And what I think is very interesting is not a single newspaper or broadcast station in the United States used the story. So the news that the experts had been coerced into agreeing with each other would have been extremely newsworthy. The news presented matter-of-factly that they disagreed with each other wasn't newsworthy at all. Bottom line, acknowledge uncertainty, acknowledge disagreement within your agency, acknowledge it matter-of-factly, expect your public to cope with it, and they will.
Peter, our final question, what is good risk communication and what makes someone a good risk communicator?
Oh, boy. All right, in three words, honesty, empathy, strategy. First, honesty. You need to tell the truth, even when you think a less than fully truthful message might be more conducive to your public health goals. Sometimes telling the truth has a short-term cost because it's a piece of the truth you'd actually rather people didn't know. But over the long haul, our reputation for total candor is far better for public health than half-truths and carefully manicured statements in order to persuade people to do what you want them to do. So honesty would be number one. Number two, empathy. You need to listen and respond empathically, validating people's valid concerns, even when you're dying to tell them how wrong they are. This is obviously particularly relevant to outrage management, but it's true across the board. If you're talking to people who already have opinions and some of their opinions are mistaken, then you are, after all, an expert. You have a master's degree, and it irritates you that the bloggers are saying things that are wrong and ignorant, and it's enormously tempting to tell them how stupid they're being. And the need to listen and the need to be empathic, that would be number two. And then number three, strategy. And this is, I think, a good thing to end this series of podcasts on. People need to realize that risk communication is a field. There's a set of principles and strategies there, and some of them are profoundly counterintuitive. Just as medicine is both a science and an art, and a good doctor can't go on intuition alone, the same is true of risk communication. And yet, and this is very frustrating to me, many health professionals don't really realize that there's a field of risk communication. They rely on their untrained risk communication intuitions. And when their ill-considered, unprofessional risk communication efforts backfire, they blame the public. I don't think risk communication is as hard to learn as public health is, but it's a field. And if you're going to do it, you owe it to yourself and you owe it to your audiences and you owe it to public health to learn how.
Thanks, Peter. This has been a very informative discussion, and I think it'll be both valuable and a good introduction to risk communication to our listeners. So thanks very much for sharing your expertise and experience with us. And thanks, Catherine, for joining us for our risk communication conversation as well. We hope you've enjoyed this podcast series on risk communication. If you have questions you'd like to ask Dr. Sandman, please join us for our upcoming web conference on Thursday, May the 5th at 10 a.m. Find out more about our web conference with Peter and other Knowledge to Action events at https://ohsconnect.osa.bc.ca.